collectively can decide, does this fit Bowen? So today we are going to hear, in part, a presentation from Parks Canada, who obviously are very knowledgeable, have been hearing back from the community, have been listening, have things to sort of say to the community. We are going to hear from a group of citizens that were selected originally by picking a series of groups on the island and asking those groups to appoint a member who would participate in a tour of the existing Gulf Islands National Park and go listen to the communities that are affected on Saturna and Pender. And so they are here to report back to you. And beyond that, then, we'll be breaking out into groups that are sort of theme-oriented, related to issues. And people can move to the issues that they want to sort of participate in a discussion of. And in that way, I think we're also being informed by ourselves, a conversation that is us speaking to ourselves about what we see as issues, opportunities, and insights. So, just before I turn it over to Naris Poole, I just wanted to make two comments. One is, we're inventing this process as we go forward. We've never been here before, and if I could speak for Parks Canada, I'm not sure they've ever been here before in terms of this particular style of consultation and this particular type of national park situated so intimately to the community and so adjacent to a major urban area. So it is a process that we can see forward a certain distance, but in a sense we are also inventing the future as we go, adapting to what comes up and listening to what is needed. And so we can see forward a certain distance, but not all the way to the end. And there are good and fair questions that are sort of sitting in the minds of islanders regarding issues that have been raised recently about how are we going to decide. How will we be clear to ourselves, to Council, Parks Canada, as to whether or not this community is behind a national park or not? So, anyways, that's really the first thought, is that we are in a process that we are inventing as we go. The second thought is really a call to be bold, to be imaginative. We have the possibility of trying to imagine a national park that would work for us. We would then be in a position to decide whether it does work for us. But the key point is, if you don't ask for something, you won't get it. And I don't think Bowen Islanders have ever been shy about asking for things. But I think it's really important that we approach it in this sort of spirit of what if. How could this work for us? What would it be if it did work for us? And I think that's a conversation we're engaged in. Always leaving open the outcome that in the end we may say, no, it doesn't fit. But if you don't imagine sort of your best case, your best possibility for something that would support this community and its future, then we won't have something to say no to. So let's invest in an effort to try and imagine this in its best and fullest way, recognizing issues, taking those issues head on, looking for workarounds, looking for ways that could accomplish a national park that would work for us. But always, and I say this again as much for myself as anybody, we are open to outcome. This process will go where it goes, and the community's opinion on this will go where it goes, and council will be a faithful listener to that opinion. So moving then, I'd like to just hand over the mic to Naris Poole, and I'd just like to introduce the three members of our National Park Committee, Councillor Doug Hooper at the far end, and Councillor Naris Poole. And Naris will take over the mic now to do further introductions. And I'm also on that park committee, yes.
Thanks, Bob. And thank you to everybody who's come out today. It's really good to see a good turnout on a sunny, what may be one of our last sunny weekends, relatively sunny. So I really appreciate, we all really appreciate the fact that you're here. I just want to outline what's going to happen this afternoon. We're going to have a presentation by Parks Canada with just about the Gulf Islands National Park Reserve, and there will be a short question and answer period at the end of that, just on that issue, on that presentation about the Gulf Islands National Park Reserve. And then we're going to move into the presentation from the community group who toured the Gulf Islands National Park Reserve, and then we'll have a longer question and answer period in which you can ask either the tour group, or you can ask Parks Canada, or you can ask the council committee if you want. So we're going to leave that pretty open-ended. And then the latter part of the afternoon will be dedicated to an opportunity to break into tables. We started out with five issues in which we've identified, or Parks Canada actually identified five issues that have kind of arisen out of the consultation feedback to date. And they're on flip charts and papers around. So we've actually added three more. The community group wanted opportunities, and they wanted affordable housing. And I actually added other for anyone who just wants to talk about anything that doesn't fit. So that makes actually eight tables. So we'll have an opportunity for people to gather at those stations in the second half of the afternoon. So I'd just like to briefly comment, too, on the next steps after today. As Bob said, we are in the process here of consultation with the community, and we're looking for ways in which we can make sure that we're reaching out to more than the group that comes out to a meeting like this. There's obviously many people on the island who have other commitments on a Saturday afternoon, not that many of you don't as well, but we need to find ways to reach those people. So we're trying to imagine how we can best engage the public that doesn't normally come out. There's website, obviously. There's just maybe having coffee meetings. There's all kinds of ways that we can do it. It's encouraging people like you in the community to talk to your neighbors. So we really need to do a job of ensuring that the people who don't come out to public meetings also have an opportunity to engage in this process. So we're working on that, and we certainly welcome ideas on that. I just want to kind of emphasize that there's two aspects to the feasibility assessment. Some of you may already be aware of what those are if you've been to any other public meetings or looked on the website. First, Parks Canada will look at the lands that are available on Bowen or that are likely to be available on Bowen, and at the moment they've identified Crown lands and any public lands, whether it's Metro Van, municipal, or provincial. And so they're going to be looking at those lands and determining, is this a place where it makes sense to have a national park on the basis of their standards of a national park? That's one part of it. The second part, which is key to both Parks Canada and certainly to Bowen Island Municipality, is what does the community want? And that is where we come in and where Bowen Island Municipality is committed to trying to engage, as I said, as many of the public as we can on that part, that second part of the consultation. So there's not going to be two separate answers. There'll be one answer at the end of the day. And yes, Parks Canada thinks there are lands here that make sense for a national park, and yes, the community wants it, or no, the community doesn't want it. So for us to get to that point, though, we've got a lot as Bob said, we've got a lot of imagining to do about what a national park on Bowen might look like. And I think that word is key. Can we be imaginative? We're in a situation here, as Bob said, that where Parks Canada generally goes into wilderness areas. Yes, they went to the Gulf Islands National Park Reserve and the islands there. That was 10 years ago. But we are faced with a lot of different issues, as many people have pointed out, that are separate from the Gulf Islands National Park Reserve. We are very close to a large metropolitan area, one reason why they're interested in us, but it also is a reason for people to have concerns about what it might mean to have a national park at the doorstep of Vancouver. So we need to think completely openly about what it is might work on Bowen Island and to bring those ideas forward. and then talk about them amongst ourselves, and at the end of the day decide, is this something that will work or not? So as part of that process, we have asked the National Park Council Committee, asked Chris Corrigan to hold an open space discussion workshop, and that's going to be held in the gym here on October 16th, another Saturday afternoon from 2:30 to 5:30. And this is basically Bowen's municipality sponsored, but it is run by Chris, and Chris will be designing his usual kind of open space discussion format. And if none of you have experienced them before, then I certainly would encourage you to come out, because it's a great way to just engage in a variety of issues without feeling that you're getting positional or oppositional. So I really would encourage those of you who have the time to come on another Saturday afternoon to come to that open space discussion. And as I said, it's completely open-ended. Chris will be figuring out exactly how that will work and what will come out of that process. And that won't be the end of it. There will be lots more opportunities for that. So having kind of laid out today and the next steps, I'd like to introduce the Parks Canada officials that we have here today. And I thank you to Parks Canada for being here and for bringing so many people. We have, I'll start at the far end, just beside Doug Hooper, we have Bill Henwood, who is the project manager for park establishment. I said something about you're the establishment guy, but that didn't quite fit. He works in the Vancouver office, and beside Bill is Wayne Bourque, who will be talking about the Gulf Islands National Park Reserve. He's the superintendent of that park reserve, and if any of you, well, I'm sure Wayne will probably deal with why it's called a reserve, so I won't deal with that. And beside Wayne, we have Robert Walker, who I said, well, what's your title? He's the fire guy. He is actually manager of resource conservation, but his specialty is fire. So any questions about fire, address them to Rob. And we also have in the audience here, we've got Debbie Funk, who is back there. She's standing way at the back. She's management of communications for Park Establishment. We have Megumi Johns, who's the consultation officer. She's just standing up at the back. And Krista Royal, who's consultation and planning officer. And Krista's just sitting at the front here. So we certainly have a great attendance from Parks Canada here today. And thank you all for coming on this Saturday afternoon. And on my right is the community group that attended the Gulf Islands National Park Reserve. And this was a group chosen by the whole of council, not just the council committee. And we tried to be representative, and we probably pushed Parks Canada to the absolute limits when it came to the numbers. Oh, you can put on another boat. We can get a few more people. So we ended up with 15 of us in total. We had eight from the community. We have Colleen O'Neill, who represented True Green and the Community Foundation. Bruce Howlett from the Bowen Island Improvement. Well, maybe I should go down the row. Sorry. Beside Colleen is Paul Rickett, who represented the Chamber. And Tim Rhodes, representing Community Housing. Bruce Howlett, representing the Bowen Island Improvement Association. Pamela Dicer, representing Eco Alliance. Peter Drake, representing the Bowen Island Conservancy. Jacqueline Massey, representing the Arts Council. And John Reed, as a developer on the island, who has done a great job of including parks in his developments. And he was invited just as a developer. And we also had five council members. There was myself, Bob Turner, Doug Hooper, Allison Morrison, Peter Frinton. And we had two staff, Hap Skelling and Brian Biddlecombe, our fire chief. So it was actually, Parks Canada did a wonderful job of showing us the park, and we had a great bonding experience. Diverse group of people, and it was actually, I found the whole thing not only enlightening in terms of finding out about the park and what's happening on the two islands, but also having an opportunity to just sit and chat with people that maybe you don't always sit and chat with. So it was really a worthwhile experience. So I will now turn it over to Wayne Bourque and ask him to present the information he has on the Gulf Islands National Park Reserve. Thank you.
Mayor, Council, thank you very much, and thank you very much for coming out today and hearing more about the proposed national park plans on Bowen Island. I wasn't going to actually talk about the reserve, so I'll talk about it real quickly right now. Under the Canada National Parks Act, you can create national parks or national park reserves. The only real difference is where there's outstanding land claims with First Nations or Aboriginal people, we call it a reserve. And that's an acknowledgement that it's subject to the land claims process, but it still has the full force of the act. So in the case of the Southern Gulf Islands, there's still three treaty processes that were involved in there, so it's a national park reserve. So the presentation today, I'm going to talk about the establishment and management of Gulf Islands National Park Reserve. We're one of the newest parks in the national park system. Our system of national parks is 125 years old this year. We are one of the oldest in the world, Banff National Park being the oldest. Gulf Islands is one of the newest. We were formally established in 2003 and just put under the Canada National Parks Act this past August. So we're one of the newest national parks in Canada. As an agency, Parks Canada is the actually oldest, or part of, how can I say this, we have the oldest park service in the world. So we have a great deal of experience in managing parks in Canada. We're seen as a leader around the world in the management of national parks. So we have that credibility with us. Today I'm just going to talk about the process that we went through to establish Gulf Islands very briefly. Every national park, it's a different process. It depends on the community, the location, the issues you're dealing with. So each one becomes a unique process. I'm going to talk about how we went about assembling the lands for Gulf Islands National Park Reserve. And then I'm going to talk about the commitments that we, either through public consultation or negotiations with the province and the Islands Trust, the commitments that we made to communities, and give you just a very brief idea of where we are. And I'm just going to talk very briefly about our organization, how Gulf Islands is actually managed. Establishment process, the National Parks Act requires that a formal agreement be reached between the federal government and the respective province or territory. And additionally, the National Parks Act also requires that there be public consultation with Aboriginal organizations, various interest groups, and representatives of the various park communities, the people that would be most affected by that. So any establishment agreements you see happening now, that's just a primary mandate that we have to do that. You cannot proceed unless you have done those things. Parliament will not hear your request to establish a national park unless you've actually done those things and they've been documented. The Gulf Islands National Park Reserve was actually originally, the process was initiated in 1994 through the Pacific Marine Heritage Legacy. This was a joint venture of the provincial government and the federal government to acquire lands. And the reason why we started with a land acquisition program in the Southern Gulf Islands was that there was literally no public land left. It was all private land. And if we were to create a national park in that area, we would have to actually buy the lands to do that. So at that time, both the federal and provincial government put $30 million each in the pot, and we used that money to buy lands over about a 7 or 8 year period. The ultimate goal of this program was to create one new national park and some new provincial parks. So that program went on until about 2003. If you look at the, let's go back one. If you look at the map, you can actually see the shaded area, and I realize it's not showing up that well on the screen here. But you can see that large shaded area that's basically on the west side of the strait. And that was the area that we were, that the two governments had agreed to acquire land. You can see Bowen Island was not in that initiative. It's basically went up to Thetis and Cooper, stayed out of Texada and the other islands south of that. So in one of the reasons why this is considered a new initiative and not part of that original initiative to create Gulf Islands. So the process to establish the Gulf Islands, while we were acquiring land, we did lots of consultation on the islands. Bill Henwood, he's gone on me already. Bill Henwood worked with a provincial counterpart at the time in terms of working with the Federal Provincial Steering Committee to select what lands would be acquired, and then I was actually quite involved in it at that time and would help to actually then acquire those properties on a willing seller, willing buyer basis. So as we acquired properties, people wanted to know how they were going to be managed, because now they had been acquired for park purposes. We didn't know if it would be part of a national park or a provincial park. So BC Parks took the lead in managing those, and we collaborated with them on the management of them. And we did consultations on the respective islands and how those lands would be acquired at the time. There was a lot of discussion at the time, what is a national park, why here, how do we get involved, how is it going to affect us, many kinds of questions that you folks are asking right now. When we completed the land acquisition program in 2002-2003 under the Pacific Marine Heritage Legacy, we did facilitate a process to develop a vision of what this national park in the Southern Gulf Islands would look like, and to also hear what the public had to say about the transfer of some of the public lands to the national park, because there were some provincial parks, ecological reserves, some marine components being considered. So there was a special advisor picked by the two governments, Greg McDade, who did public consultations throughout the Gulf Islands based on that vision or what that concept of what it would look like. And we actually got resounding approval. There was very little negative voices made about the park. People were much in favor of it. In fact, the public recommended additional lands be part of the national park. So, just the next slide. So, I'm not sure if you can see that map well. It's not showing up that clearly, but you can see those dark spots primarily on the Pender Islands and Saturn and some on Prevost Island. So those were some of the lands that were actually acquired between 1994 and 2003. Actually, there's been a few more added that are on that map now that have been bought since the National Park was established. But basically, that's what we bought. Now, there was many other properties bought north of here, but those have become provincial parks. So then there was the issue of what lands would be transferred. And Saturna Island really was the only island that had some Crown land on it. There was a couple of quarter sections of Crown land. There was ecological reserves. There were some provincial parks there, Winter Cove, Cabbage Island. On the Penders, there was Prior Centennial Campground. There was one block of Crown land there. There was Beaumont, a marine provincial park, and Mount Norman, the Capital Regional District Park. There was other parks such as people know it as Portland or Princess Margaret, Sydney Spit, and Darcy Island. So that's largely what the facilitation with Greg McDade looked at. Was it plausible to transfer those lands for national park purposes? So what you have now and what just came under the Canada National Parks Act is that combination of acquired lands and those provincial parks, ecological reserves, and some small pieces of Crown land. Can't see it too well on there. There's some dark blue on there, but there was also some marine components, especially those that were previously part of some of the provincial parks. So those were all transferred to the federal government to become part of the provincial park. Yeah, I was told it takes 20 minutes for the lights to come back on, so sorry about that. So that is what's been formally established as the national park. This next map, you can just barely see some lighter blue areas on there, and those lands are pending addition to the national park. Parks Canada is managing them. They are adjacent submerged lands, and that's all pending the outcome of a study to create an additional area called the National Marine Conservation Area, something that Bill Henwood and his team are also leading right now. We're hoping there'll be some conclusion to that feasibility study now. It was also formally initiated in 1994, but really didn't get underway until 2004, Bill, I guess? Yeah, so that whole area is now being managed as a National Park Reserve, but the light blue areas, if a marine conservation area is created, they would be put under the Marine Conservation Area and not under the Gulf Islands National Park Reserve. So in the process of all those public consultations we did since 1994 and up to 2003, there was lots of commitments being made to the public. Those were dealt with in negotiations with the province in the final agreement to establish the national park. One of those was the cooperation with First Nations. Again, respecting existing treaty rights, and then additionally to consult on the planning and management of the National Park Reserve over time. So since that time, we've established three formal committees with, I believe it's 12 of the 17 First Nations that have served rights on the Southern Gulf Islands. We sit at two treaty tables. One treaty has been subsequently settled since then. And we also do additional consultation with the First Nations who are not participating in committee with us right now on key issues that are of interest to them. The other thing, and some of you I think have picked them up, is that we were committed to doing interim management guidelines as soon as possible once the park was established. The park was established in 2003. Through public consultation, we completed those interim management guidelines in 2006. Now, these interim management guidelines took a precautionary approach. In other words, we would err on the side of conservation, deal with the immediate issues that were confronting land management in the national park, and also to prescribe a process on the information we needed to gain so we could make informed decisions in the management planning process. We've also done specific area plans to resolve some of the more intensive land management areas. So we did winter area plans for Winter Cove, Sydney Spit, Portland Island, Narvaez Bay, and Roseland. And again, every one of those included public consultation, either on the vision, the concept, what kind of uses would be take place there, what kind of restrictions would take place in all those lands. And we did those with a variety of groups, just not the local interests. We are now in the process now where the park has completed what we call a State of the Parks report. In other words, we've spent over 5 years now collecting all kinds of information. A lot of that has been through various studies that we've done on the park, or information that's come to us from other levels of government or the local communities or individuals. So we've summarized all that information now. It should be approved just about any day. It will be available to the public. That document really highlights what we've basically learned about all the lands that are now in the national park and what are the key issues that we need to deal with in the upcoming management planning process. So the other thing that was a commitment was to create a park advisory board. And this board was established, and this was done through the agreement to provide advice on planning and management of the national park. The board has been set up to strive for consensus. There's a member of the Capital Regional District, one Islands Trust member. There's three people that are picked to choose or to represent the public interest. And there's two Parks Canada people that sit on the board. And the two Parks Canada people, one is myself and one is another staff, and we're like ex officio. We don't have any voting status on the board. We're just there to listen and hear and provide information, advice as needed. We've also established several community liaison committees, some of which the committee that came over to the island met with both the liaison committee on Pender Islands and the one from Saturna Island. Those committees are largely made up of area interests, various organizations on the island that feel that they have some interest in the park or they have an interest that the park should be dealing with. And they're sort of self-defined community groups. We didn't go out there and say, you know, how do you want to do this? They basically came to us. The one on Saturna has been working now since 2005. The Pender one was just started last year. But we found that they're an excellent group of people to work with. It's a good place to sit and talk about the issues specific to their community and to their island. Now, one of the things that some of you may have heard of, well, what happens to our tax base when these lands go over to a national park? The federal government, there is an act called Payments in Lieu of Taxes, and it's for any federal land. So whether it's military lands, it's Environment Canada lands, it's First Nations lands, Parks Canada lands, the federal government makes payments in lieu of taxes to the local taxation authority. And that's a specific act that requires us to do that. It is administered by Public Works and Government Services Canada for all federal departments. They set the rate that they pay, so the federal government actually sets the rate, because you can't have one order of government taxing another order of government. So the federal government sets the rates that are paid, and the rates that they pay are based on the use of the property, in terms of how is that federal property being used. The taxes, we start making, not the taxes, but those payments are paid once the property has been transferred to Canada. And in the Gulf Islands, it's been a bit of a mixed bag, because some of the lands by 2003 actually had been acquired directly by the federal government, so we started making those payments right away on those. But we only accepted transfer of all the provincial lands last month, so now we'll start making payments on all those lands. Up till that time, as provincial lands, there was no payments being made either from the province or the federal government on those lands. So the other agreement we had made was to look at how we can support the local fire and ambulance services on the islands, and so we now have agreements in place both with the Pender and Saturna Islands emergency services, their fire and ambulance services. We make some financial commitments for services they provide on the lands. Additionally, on Saturna Island, we have participated and they built a new recreational hall there. We put our offices in that building to help provide funding and support for that. We're now putting money into their new fire hall emergency services building. Again, it'll provide us with some space, but it helps them with their initiatives to get these services done. With respect to the municipal services that every property owner gets, we pay the bills for utilities just like anybody else, water, sewer, whatever the services that may be provided. Another commitment, again, on Saturna Island, which is fairly remote and not the best ferry service. There, they wanted to have a helipad maintained. It was in the provincial park. We've actually established two helipads on the island that meet Transport Canada standards. There was things much like Crippen Park is here on Saturna Island, Winter Cove Provincial Park, had many community activities, events taking place there. So we've actually done a license of occupation with them so they can maintain those operations and services there. There was also some concerns about some of the water bodies in the park. How would Parks Canada work with the local government in terms of managing those services? So we've been working with the Capital Regional District on One Lake, where they have a specific interest there. After environmental assessments, the CRD, or the Capital Regional District, we basically put it on the back burner. It's not something that anybody wants to proceed with right now, but they still maintain the right to take water from that lake in the future. Other things were, you know, again, the islanders were looking for commitments to employment opportunities. And so there's been a real push, and this has been a concern on the islands about if we're staffing up and we need to have staff on the islands, can we do our best to try to hire local people? Well, we can do that to the extent that federal legislation, policy, and practices allow us to do that. Those are largely driven by the Treasury Board of Canada, so we have to live up to those. So we have been creative sometimes in trying to fulfill this commitment, but it does make it quite difficult sometimes. But really, as a federal government, you have to offer equal opportunity to all Canadians. With respect to other economic opportunities, again, the idea was to try to give preference to local entrepreneurs, local businesses. We certainly do that where we can, but again, when you get caught up in agreements like NAFTA, federal purchasing policies, we have to play by all those rules too. So where we can, we do work with local businesses. The commitment to ferries, again, because we're working on a variety of islands there, was really just one to make sure that Parks Canada is doing what it can when people are on the ferries to educate them about the national park and some of the concerns of the islanders. So certainly people on the islands wanted us to make sure that visitors were aware of the fire concerns they had about the use of bicycles on the road, the fact that if you're bringing anything with you, make sure you take your garbage out with you, those kinds of things. So we've done that on the ferries, and now we actually are participating in the Coastal Naturalist Program on the main runs of the ferry that some of you may have been on. So we co-fund that with the ferry service in terms of, again, doing an interpretive element to the program on the ferries also. The other commitment was is because we took over 7 provincial parks in the process, many people were concerned that we may change the types of activities or the services that would be provided in those. So we've made the, maintained the commitment to maintain those services, that full range of services, pending us doing a management plan. And again, when we do management planning, it's a full public consultation process. That we also would maintain a low impact approach to any services we would provide. And additionally, that the fees that were being charged in the provincial park would stay in place pending management planning, and we would not introduce any new fees until we went through a management planning process. So those are just some of the commitments. That was, I would think, probably the highlights of the commitments made to communities. In terms of our organization, Parks Canada is actually a fairly flatline organization. We have a chief executive officer. We are an agency, not a department. So our chief executive officer is like a deputy minister at the federal level. He has a very flat organization where the directors for various programs and what we call field unit superintendents report directly to him. And under the field unit superintendents, where someone like me or a park reports to them. So it's a very flat-lined organization. It isn't that it's really wide, but it's not really high in terms of depth of layers of organization. So when you get down to this field unit level, which is sort of a regional approach to how we manage our parks and historic sites across the country, my boss, who has been to some of the meetings today, Steve Langdon, he couldn't be here today. He's considered the field unit superintendent. But in this chart, you can see not only is he responsible for Gulf Islands National Park, he's responsible for Pacific Rim, Fort Langley National Historic Site in the Lower Mainland, and then for Biscard Lighthouse and Fort Rod Hill in Victoria, plus a whole variety of other programs that he's responsible for. Additionally, that's where our human resources capacity lies. That's where our asset manager is located and our finance manager. When you get down to the Gulf Islands organization, I haven't shown you all the positions here. I have a staff complement right now of about 52 people this year that are working in the various offices and on different islands. But basically, we saw Rob Walker is here. He's our resource conservation manager. We have a manager who's specifically responsible for managing the visitor experience in terms of kind of services we offer the public. I have one officer who works directly as a liaison with the 19 different First Nations that we work with in the Southern Gulf Islands. We have a visitor facilities and assets manager, and we have an administrative group. You can't really see all the words down there, I apologize for that, but largely that's the nature of our organization, how we manage all the different islands. We have, I think, 7 staff on Pender Island this year, and 3 or 4 on Saturna. The remainder worked out of our Sydney office this year. So we're hoping that next year we're going to get a few more people on Saturna Island. But that's sort of where we are with our organization right now. So I don't have any other things to present you today. I just was told to keep it short and sweet. So I just wanted to thank you again for being here. And again, just a quick presentation on what the National Park and the Gulf Islands is all about. So.
So we have 5 or 10 minutes for questions specifically about Wayne's presentation for park staff. We'll then move to the community group, and there'll be question and answers following that. But specifically to this presentation, if you have a question, please come up to the mic. I just wanted to cover one point that was brought up. We didn't have an optimal situation here in terms of presenting. That was sort of fuzzy to a lot of people. But we will be posting on the Bowen Island Municipality website this talk, as well as the phase 1. You all got copies of this, so that's not so big a deal. The phase 1, what we heard from Parks Canada, that'll be on our website in the next week or so. And also, there's an interim management plan. There were committee copies here. I think not everybody got a copy who wanted a copy. And so there'll be a link on the Parks Canada website to that interim management plan for the Southern Gulf Islands National Park. So that's a third piece of the puzzle if you didn't get a copy here. But anyways, I'll just turn it over to Wayne for questions. Anybody at the mic? I'm not seeing any. Oh, Ian?
Anyway, did refer to the Aboriginal agreement. Do you have a copy of that agreement so we can see what kind of an agreement we can expect to see? And does that agreement include the rights for Aboriginal people to harvest on park land?
Okay, so
logging,
right,
specifically.
Okay, well, let's just me talk about the latter point first, and that's harvesting. So national park lands are subject to Aboriginal rights, so there's no agreement required. First Nations have every right to harvest on the Crown lands that you have here on the island now, and they would have the same on national park lands. If there are treaties in place, the same treaty rights apply. So there's no agreement required for that. They have the right to do that. In terms of the agreements we have with First Nations, they were not part of the park establishment agreement. They're separate agreements that we have made with them. And those are agreements basically to consult and accommodate First Nations. And when I say accommodate, that is being respectful of their interests on the lands and the use of the lands, and that we're trying to accommodate them where we can within our mandate and within our means. So those agreements are specifically to set up a committee with them and to consult with them on planning, area planning, mansion planning. Some of the First Nations are quite interested in some of the developments that's going on, and their concerns there are largely with regards to the management of cultural resources or archaeological resources. So oftentimes they're quite interested in some of the environmental assessments that we do. Those agreements with the that we have with First Nations right now are not public documents. I believe the one with the Halkin-Meenum Treaty Group is actually posted on their website. Pretty sure it's posted on their website. Don't quote me on that. I'll have to check. But if you wanted agreements, I would have to ask the respective First Nations, and if they're agreeable to that, then we certainly could share them with you. So. Because there are agreement between two partners. So as long as both parties agree, then it can be made public.
You've got a few questions, actually.
Yep.
First is, what are we talking about a part of the Gulf Islands National Reserve, or are we talking about a Bowen Island National Park or National Reserve?
It could be either one, actually. The intent here is that this, the province and the federal government have agreed that this is a new initiative. So if the vision, I would say if the vision here was so different, but it was still feasible, but it was so different from the Gulf Islands, it could be a separate national park. But our organization, as we do elsewhere in the organization, it would still be managed by the administration of Gulf Islands National Park Reserve. Or it can be made part of Gulf of Islands National Park Reserve.
I guess the second question, a little bit following up that, and following up Ian's question, apart from a picture that I've seen in a local propaganda piece of an arrowhead that washed up on the shore of Cape Roger Curtis, I'd like to know what evidence we have that the native people have actually lived on this island. Are there middens or anything like that that would suggest that we have, do we have some reason to make an agreement with them on Bowen Island?
We haven't done an archaeological assessment, but the one thing that we did do in the Southern Gulf Islands, once the land was acquired, we have done full archaeological investigations. And a lot of that is recorded already with the BC government, so they have it in their archives already. We haven't specifically looked at that yet. So,
I would think that if we're part of the Gulf Islands National Reserve, we would have to follow suit with respect to native land claims and so on. But if we're a separate park, we might not have to follow that unless there's evidence that the natives have a claim here.
Okay. The way the Gulf Islands work is that there's 19 different First Nations that assert interest in that area. None of them assert interest on Bowen Island. So the only First Nation, well, there's two groups of First Nations. The Squamish First Nations assert interest in the land area here, and the Halkin-Meenum Treaty Group assert interest in the marine area, not on the land. So we've determined that through both the federal and provincial treaty offices in terms of which First Nations claim right. So you wouldn't be working with the First Nations in the Southern Gulf Islands. Yeah, here would be the Squamish First Nation, and if there are some marine components, there may be some interest there with the Halkin-Meenum Treaty Group.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. The other question I had, and this is really not something you brought up, but something Nara School just brought up prior to your discussion. I heard the word municipal lands, and that's the first time I've heard that in the discussion. But it might be under discussion with respect to Bowen Island and your issue. So I would either ask you or Naris to actually answer that question. What municipal lands are you talking about?
So what we've done, Hugh, is we have provided Parks Canada with a map of all municipal lands. And we've basically said to them by council resolution, take a look, and if you have interests, let's talk. We've made no commitments, but we have been very open about our land holdings and asked them to take a look, and if there is interest on their part, then it would be part of a very public discussion as to any sort of transfer of ownership.
Would that include beach accesses?
The map we transferred was a lands map. You're asking a good question.
On the sort of kind of research that we could do trying to find out some of the impact of the national park, creation of the national park, I'm just going through some of the parks currently in existence, and the one I sort of logged into was Bruce Peninsula, which also has a marine park attached to it, and saw that the sort of claim around it is that within 5 hours' drive of this park, 9 million Canadians live, and so presumably the creation of that park, and as fragmented as it is, might stand as something of a model for what's being created here. But my question to you is then, if not Bruce Peninsula, can you point to other parks in your system that, or in your own examination of kind of impact in a local area, are there parks you can use as models or direct us to that start to show changes in patterns of visitation? That kind of the impact of cars, et cetera, et cetera.
I think in terms of when we did our business case, in terms of how we're going to operate the Southern Gulf Islands, Bruce Peninsula was one of the places, but Georgian Bay Islands was one that was quite similar. It's not far from Bruce Peninsula, actually, it's just across Lake Huron. That was probably the one that best matched what we've done in the Southern Gulf Islands. You can look at St. Lawrence Islands, which is fairly close to Montreal in the St. Lawrence River. Not quite the same model, but again, on islands, marine environment. Other places are Mingan National Park, which is in the Mingan, M-I-N-G-A-N. It's in Quebec, close to Newfoundland. I guess probably those are the ones where you're going to have the marine components to them. Probably closest to what we're trying to do in the Southern Gulf Islands.
I mean, do you imagine once a park might be established and once a management plan is in place, that there would be an effort to, say, remove invasive species? Would there be an effort to reintroduce certain mammals or other animal forms that might be have historically been here and maybe been removed? Is there that kind of effort that might come out of creating a park?
There's a huge effort because the key mandate of a national park is ecological integrity, so restoration of ecosystems is our primary consideration. If you read the Canada National Parks Act, it's just exactly what it says, primary consideration as is ecological integrity. The other additional piece of legislation that drives us there is the Federal Species at Risk Act, where again we have to look at listed species, come up with recovery plans, and then implement those in national parks. In our case, in the Southern Gulf Islands, as much as I've seen here, you have many invasive plants, so that's one of our biggest issues. So we're just engaging some of the local communities right now through various organizations and our own staff to start working on the invasive species. But also, there are a number of species that are at risk in the park, and so there's now some work being done to reintroduce some of those species or to recover them, or at least give them an alternate place for habitat. So,
thank you.
So that was my question. Is the time up?
But this will be the last question.
Okay. So my question was just to follow up on the precedents that might exist in Canada or in the world for a large, relatively large population within, let's say, half an hour's access. confidence in within Parks Canada or the team that the capability of grappling with the issues that come with that? Do you feel confident?
Well, I think as Naris and the mayor said, one of the reasons Parks Canada is really interested in Bowen Island is, again, it's your proximity to a large urban community.
Right.
For us, the reality is that as Canada becomes a more urbanized country, fewer and fewer Canadians are connecting with nature. So whether it's younger Canadians or new Canadians, and unless we can be relatively close, and you already have a large visitation of people here from the Lower Mainland, and if we can engage those people, educate them about the National Park Mandate, why we're here, what we do, why it's important, then we're gaining a lot of public support for the mandate. It's one of our concerns that as we become a more urban population, less connection with nature, that the rationale for protected areas is being lost and we become less and less relevant. So in terms of right now, our agency is actively looking at opportunities in Toronto and Montreal and Vancouver. Some of you may have seen in the news last week, there was something about the Rouge Valley in Toronto again, where the people are pushing to see that made a national park, and again, for that national park-urban interface. Montreal, we're actually in pretty good shape with national historic sites. The canal that goes through the city is managed by Parks Canada, so we can engage people through that program. So it's one of our key initiatives to do that. And I know there was actually a meeting of the major world senior managers in Victoria here last year, and that was a common concern of all the national park systems that attended. They all agreed that they're losing relevance to their population as we urbanize, and it's becoming really important. So there's many countries in the world saying, well, how can we connect national parks with people? Mm-hmm. So
great. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
So we're going to move on. I'll let Naris make our transition. There was at least one question that didn't get asked. So after this discussion, both Parks Canada staff and our citizens group are here. So those questions are all fair game. Thanks.
Real simple shift over. Over to Colleen to introduce or to talk about the tour group.
Hi. So a few of us have been cherry-picked from this group to read our report, but at the end of the report, you can ask questions of anybody that attended our little tour. So this is the introduction. 7 years ago, the Gulf Islands National Park Reserve was created to protect parcels of land on a number of Gulf Islands. Municipal Council invited Parks Canada to consider establishing a national park on Bowen and possibly be part of the Gulf Islands National Park Reserve. As part of the process, the National Park Committee of Council asked a number of organizations to send a representative each on a fact-finding mission to both Pender, North and South Pender, and Saturna. The intent was to connect with Gulf Islanders and get a sense of their experience of living in close proximity to a national park. The delegation was asked to observe, explore, and identify issues that might arise for Bowen if we were to become a national park. So where did we go? What did we do? On September the 8th, we traveled by BC Ferries to Sturdy's Bay on Galliano, where we met Parks Canada staff. They transported us in their vessels to tour the Parks Canada lands on Pender Island first. We reviewed park facilities at Roseland, which was a formerly privately owned cottage resort by the sea, now run by the Parks Canada. Then we met with a contingent of Pender Islanders at their community center. We posed many questions to the group, asking the pros and cons of their national park. After the meeting, we toured Prior Centennial, which is a 17-site drive-in campground that was an existing provincial campground before the creation of the national park and is now part of the national park. Then we boarded the Parks Canada boats headed to Saturna, where 44% of land on Saturna is now national park. We had dinner there in the company of islanders with whom we were able to chat informally about the national park. Later that evening, we met approximately with 15 Saturna Islanders at one of their community halls. They have two. And engaged in a lively round of questioning and felt we received very candid answers from a wide variety of people from the island. The next morning on Saturna began with a tour of the new community center, which has a performance-based gymnasium, industrial kitchen, lounge, medical center, and Parks Canada office. We also met with a number of Parks Canada personnel, including park wardens. Later that morning, we were taken by car to Winter Cove and a nearby ball festival field. Although this has been incorporated into the national park lands, events continue to be held there as usual, which is relevant to our Bowfest field. We followed a boardwalk and trails that had been relocated away from a First Nations archaeological site. Our last stop in Saturna was Navarez Bay. We arrived by boat and had a tour of their new, this is their first campsite in Saturna, a new seven-site walk-in-only campground or kayak boat-in-only, which is 1.7 kilometers from the trailhead. After returning to the boats, we sped past Tumbo Island, Cabbage Island, Bennett Bay, Bell Chain, and which are all part of the Gulf Islands National Park Reserve. Throughout our tour, three very knowledgeable members of Parks Canada local staff were on hand to address our constant questions and concerns in both a group setting and one-on-one basis. Council members and municipal staff took a back seat on the tour, allowing reps, us from the organizations, to take the lead in asking questions. This is not to say they didn't participate. The five counselors on the tour played a vital role in getting our questions answered. Prior to the tour, we compiled a series of questions for the trip, which covered a wide range of topics. So during our journey home and at a subsequent meeting on Bowen, we recorded the answers we received and identified lists of potential opportunities and concerns based on the tour, as well as our own individual conversations with people on Bowen over the past few months. We initially attempted to problem solve some of the concerns, or at least get a sense of how we would address the issues that became evident to us. However, for purposes of this report, we felt that we should exclude what we may have identified as possible solutions. We felt that at this very early stage of information gathering and dissemination, it was premature to attempt a solution-driven presentation or steer the discussions in any specific direction. We all feel privileged to have been part of the tour. We sincerely hope that these observations will inform and inspire more detailed conversation and consideration of opportunities and concerns that the community might face as it contemplates whether a national park is appropriate for Bowen Island. The next section presents summarized answers, and they're quite summarized because there are quite a few of them, to these wide-ranging questions. We recognize that the answers may not be complete enough to fulfill the community's needs because we just didn't get the answers always that we needed. Time constraints in the trip prevented some more detailed discussion. The lessons to be learned, especially on tourism, may not be applicable to Bowen Island, given our proximity to Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. And our questions themselves will hopefully inspire more questions from the community. We divided up the task so that we have a few voices here so you don't fall asleep. Peter Drake compiled the first list of questions, and they were all conservancy-based because he's on the conservancy, of course. So he's going to read that section for you.
Good afternoon. I'm dealing with nine questions here. The first one is, how are ecologically sensitive areas managed within larger national parks? Are there different levels of zones of protection, and what are they? The answer was yes. There are five management park development zones in national park management planning process. And this varies from zone one, which is special preservation, is basically a no-go area, all the way to zone five, which is park services and where they keep their offices. Second question is, how have local conservancy groups found dealing with Parks Canada? Positive, difficult, confusing. We've sort of broken it up into three one-word or multi-choice questions. And basically the answer coming from them was positive. How have locals found the visitor factor? This looms high in a lot of different contexts. And unfortunately there, it's really unknown, because since the parks were initiated, there's been a downturn in the economy, especially as it pertains to visitors from the States. And that's influenced visitation. And on top of that, they don't have a turnstile. They don't count visitors, so they really don't have any accurate numbers on visitors. There's sort of anecdotal comments, but nobody's very sure of the numbers. How do islanders deal with conflicts between Parks Canada conservancy focus versus their focus on recreation? Well, first of all, they're dealt with as part of the management planning, interim management plan guidelines, which includes general public consultation as well as targeted consultation with the advisory board. And Wayne already explained that to you in the earlier talk just now. And then there are local liaison committees on Pender Island, on Saturna. Another aspect to that question is the conservancy versus recreation. So although Parks Canada's new mandate, and they keep talking about this, is the attract a large urban audience to enjoy what they call the park experience, it didn't seem as though they were prepared to sacrifice conservation and cultural values in their efforts to increase the number of park visitors. Fifth question, well, what has been the role of the local conservancy groups during and since National Parks Initiative? Well, they've all served, not all of them, but most of them have been serving on local liaison committees. And I've appointed Michael Dunn, for example, he's a member of the Main Island Conservancy Group and on the Island Trust Fund Board. The Main Island Conservancy work hand in hand with Parks Canada, and they even hold interpretive events on their behalf, as Parks Canada don't have permanent staff on Maine. So they're working very closely there. How do various management plans look like? How adapted in reality are they to local sites and preferences? They're similar to other management planning documents, and if you look at the Parks Canada website, you get a lot of information on that. And we asked Parks Canada to provide us with existing interim management guidelines for the Gulf Islands National Park Reserve, and also asked that they could be posted on the website so the public can view them. Well, Parks Canada is in the process of initiating the overall management plan for the Gulf Islands National Park Reserve in keeping with its management planning process. So we weren't really able to have a look. What has enforcement been like within parks, and how effective has it been? Mixed answers. Some groups are pleased with the level of protection to archaeological sites and to ecosystems. Others were frustrated with losing control over what they thought of previously as their own public lands, to use on as they feel fit. And there's some feelings here, I guess. Some examples are taking a car to a popular lookout spot, or using a well for water, having dogs off leash, having weddings on park lands. They've had some problems with some of these issues. Other ways to avoid or minimize the challenges, i.e. can we find solutions to these challenges? Well, the answer basically from everybody was yes. For most issues, there do seem to be potential solutions. However, these islands don't have the ferry issues that Bowen has, given our proximity to Vancouver and the Lower Mainland, and we really didn't address those concerns. And this is one of our most critical concerns on Bowen, the possible commuting chaos. So my final one in my little area was, what advice did we receive from the islanders about having a national park, and how can it be applied to Bowen Island? Well, very clear message came back was, make sure we're clear about what we want, and conversely what we don't want. Do that up front and negotiate accordingly, and try and speak with a united voice. Get our consensus before we start negotiating with Parks Canada. Thanks.
If you have the document in front of you, I'm going to speak to sections G1 through B4. And our very first question to the islanders over there really was, overall non-balance, has the establishment of a national park been a positive or negative for the existing community? And absolutely, they said it's been a positive. In most cases, they wouldn't go back, they wouldn't unwind this deal after 7 years of experience. So the major positives and negatives. Positives: assurance of land protection in perpetuity. Ecosystems are actively managed and enforced, potential economic for local business, sense of relief that their islands were saved, consultation process, in that Parks Canada promises to take the lead from Bowen Islands in addressing their concerns with the impact of National Park, the potential collaboration between local organizations and volunteers in Parks Canada, resulting in effective delivery of organizational mandates, possible infrastructure support, this has been demonstrated there, emergency service upgrades, road and trail upgrades, and contributions to public spaces, including perhaps rental income in a community center, building similar to Saturnet Island Community Center, possibility of private land donations to a national park, and educational and research opportunities. The negatives they identified for us were living with the big elephant and a cumbersome bureaucracy, it is a federal agency, slow and lack of responsiveness, somewhat hierarchical decision process in that every decision is referred to Ottawa, so little local authority, lack of capacity by the islanders themselves to deal with this issue because they're not as structured maybe as we are. Lack of information sharing, that's communications between the community and Parks Canada, seemingly keeping islanders uninformed about the initial agreement that was struck. They did experience a loss of sense of freedom and ownership of what was historically thought of theirs by right of custom. And certainly noted on Saturna, loss of taxation monies from purchase of private land. On Saturna, they said all services have suffered due to lack of funds because of fewer tax dollars, and taxes increased by 34% over the last 4 years. Other negatives, Parks Canada license fees and possible increased insurance rates for private contractors. Local contractors have to bid for local work, and the federal bidding process can be daunting. This has frustrated some local contractors. Increased demand on emergency services, and there is no divorce. Once we buy in, they're with us forever. Having Parks Canada in the governance loop to change relations with the Islands Trust and the Capital Regional District? I should point out there, the Saturna and Pender aren't incorporated, so they are governed by the CRD and the Islands Trust. And what impact, if any, has the insertion of a third layer had, i.e. Parks Canada? Resolution of issues that are park-related is difficult in some circumstances because the governing body is in Ottawa and the communication tools are by Pony Express. How has the community consultation process worked after the establishment of the park? What issues have caused most debate? Although Parks Canada has established mechanisms to communicate with islanders, the lack of access to the original agreement between the province and Parks Canada has left them in an impossible situation redefending their rights because they are simply not aware of those rights. Although islanders can be taken to task for not knowing their rights, PC must take responsibility for restricting access to the document that was signed by both parties or parties representing the islanders. Legally, the clout of Parks Canada far outweighs the local volunteers and residents. Parks Canada should be taken to task for not being a more benign landlord in this regard. Has tourism increased, and what impacts? Unclear due to economic downturn, you heard this from Peter. Saturna has said they had lost their American visitors. As fact finders, we were reminded by locals that Bowen's visitor numbers could be significantly different given its proximity to Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. Has access been increased in any way since the park was established? Increased, have there been more ferry schedules, more services to bring people to and from the island? The answer is no, nothing has changed for them in terms of that 7 years. What were the most anticipated concerns before Parks Canada took over, i.e. in the consultation planning process, and did these concerns materialise? The islands were concerned during their negotiations, litter, ferry overloads, fire, garbage, noise, rowdiness, fear of resource development. None of these concerns have materialised to date. What, if any, unanticipated effects have been experienced after the establishment of the park? They've had some more regulation enforcement and they feel some disenfranchisement some ponderous problems in solving, lack of capacity to deal with Parks Canada. Having been through the process, to what would you advise us, i.e. Bowen Island, to pay the most attention? The continuation of existing uses, close attention to details, know what is in your agreement. Negotiate hard up front for the things you want or don't want to see on your island, as after the fact it's more difficult to deal with this bureaucracy. Make sure that these details go into the agreement. G7, have firefighting facilities been upgraded as a result of the park? If so, who paid for these, park or other level of government? Parks Canada prepaid rent for a significant time period, 40 years, although I'll allow Parks Canada to correct that if it's not a complete accurate statement, for a space in the new main Saturna Fire Hall in which to store some of their own firefighting and rescue equipment. This gave the island a useful lump sum. The replacement of the main hall and construction of a satellite hall on Saturna have been in the works since 1996 and are funded by the taxpayers of the island. PC has bought additional fire equipment, main fire hall, by the way. PC has bought more additional fire equipment on island that is shared with the community fire department. They also share training sessions. B1, has the park resulted in the opening of new businesses? If so, what types? Generally, no. It's been a very limited economic impact, direct economic impact on the two islands. Has the park impacted existing businesses? How? Some license fees for businesses active within the park, like guides and tour operators, and increased insurance rates have occurred. Saturna Island General Store reported an increase in its business since the park. Parks Canada has also supported the cost of Saturna Island's tourism promotion efforts. What businesses have had to qualify for Parks Canada approval? How was the process slash benefit? 25 businesses have commercial recreation permits within the GINPR. Some of these are not new businesses generated by the new park, just businesses that have permits to work within the park. Saturna Island has just two recreation contractors who work in the park, whale watching cruises and a kayaking company. One contractor thinks the relationship with Parks Canada will benefit his business more significantly once they put his information on their website, which has been promised but has not, or had not, at least when we were there, happened yet. How many jobs have been created on islands? Don't know.
I'm going to speak to some of the social issues. What are the most common issues that arose between existing communities and Parks Canada? And we've said it before, the slowness, regulations, loss of sense of community, ponderous bureaucratic decision making. Has the community been enhanced because of the park? Generally, islanders felt that their experience of their islands was enhanced due to the insurance that their green spaces won't be developed for housing or be logged. Any negative social impacts, and what were they? Fatigue, angst, loss of sense of ownership. Parks Canada sometimes acts unilaterally without local consultation. How effective is the ongoing consultation process between the community and Parks Canada? Both islands reported congenial and often mutually beneficial relationships, especially with local Parks Canada staff. But there was some frustration from some community members, re-communication and consultation between themselves and the federal Parks Canada bureaucracy. Some members also felt that after living with Parks Canada for a number of years, this situation has been improving. Because islanders do not have access to the Provincial Park Establishment Agreement, Federal Provincial Park Establishment Agreement, they do not have any mechanism to easily resolve these issues that have come up or to take to a higher authority, i.e. they cannot monitor adherence to the agreement. Have property prices changed because of the park and how? Not that we noticed or that anybody reported to us when we asked. Has the park impacted housing in any way in terms of increased need for affordable housing, rentals, etc.? We asked these questions, nobody knew the answer to that. Although fees, excluding camping, are not currently charged for park access on the islands, what is the community's views on possible future fees? They're not charged at the moment. And residents felt that they should have a residence pass, a free pass. Were these conflicts between were there conflicts between existing OCPs and parks, and how were they resolved? The only thing we heard is that Saturn is in the process of amending their OCP so that the lands in the park are zoned as park. Bowen is concerned about the impact of on-leash rules for dogs on what is currently public land. What has been your experience with Parks Canada and enforcement? The rules are generally enforced, but people are often just given warnings. In terms of park-specific questions, were there campsites on the islands before Parks Canada? So in Pender, as we said, there were 17 drive-in campsites, and they're still being used, but of course now managed by Parks Canada, not provincially. And on Saturna, there weren't any campsites, and now there's 7, and it seems as if the community are pleased with these campsites. They're well-maintained. They're only accessed by walk-in, cycle-in, but you have to walk your bike in, not ride it in, kayak in, or boat in. And they looked very neat and tidy. What were the community concerns about the new campsites, fire, rowdiness, noise? And that hasn't really cropped up as a big issue for the islanders yet. Have there been any issues with increased camping? No, in that the number of campsites have not been increased. The fears associated with Saturna's walk-in campsite have not been realized. There have been no wildfires reported during Parks Canada's watch. Has increased enforcement and monitoring by Parks Canada employees caused issues with community practices that existed pre-park, i.e. unleashed dogs and whatever else you might think of? Yes, see previously mentioned issues. So we talked about people used to have weddings on park land. They now have to get a permit, and there's restrictions as to how many people can be in the wedding party if it's protected lands. There was parking at some viewpoints and some parts of Pender that have now been blocked off to cars because of protection of the road base, I think it was. And they had a water pump up there that Parks Canada closed that they used to use historically, but Park Canada was worried about the quality of water, so the locals were irritated about that. Leash dogs has caused frustration. There's been a loss of access to roads blocked off for reasons by Parks Canada. So there was a gate across a road to a low bank access. And it was closed for protection of a native midden, which is like a burial site. And that had been used for kayak access for the kayaking company because it was a low bank access on the other side of the island that the guy could put in people at this end and pull them up at that end. Well, that was blocked to him, so he now has to use private lands to pull up his kayaks. And it was an emergency service access, but the locals had difficulty finding the key to the gate to get to the emergency access. Apparently it took them a year to get the key to the gate. For Bowen, what is the estimate of number of Parks Canada employees, full-time or part-time, that might need to be based on Bowen? We don't have accurate numbers, but Parks Canada thinks anywhere from 5 to 15, depending on what programs we decide we might like on Bowen, if we decide we have a national park. Are Parks Canada employees required to be bilingual? Yes, for positions that require meeting visitors, such as wardens and interpreters. And if MVRD, Metro Vancouver Regional District Park, on Bowen's, if the Metro Vancouver Regional District Park on Bowen subsumed into park, will existing Metro employees be given preference in transferring to Parks Canada? That was not addressed. Okay, opportunities. I think, Paul, are you going to speak? Oh, Peter, right.
Okay, so it's going to be a little bit repetitive because this comes out of the answers, really, but worth enforcing. So based on the mission we undertook there, we recognized a number of opportunities or potential opportunities that the National Park could provide. And these are just listed in alphabetical order, so we don't get involved in saying one is more important than the other. So first of the 15 of them, additional provision of park-related recreation, heritage, and cultural facilities is one opportunity. There could be direct contribution to Bowen economy through annual National Park expenditures, and that includes operation and maintenance of and capital development on Bowen. There'd be enhanced management of natural and cultural values or cultural areas and that include heritage resources, establishment of interpretive programs and involvement with community schools on park projects. We'd have a federal partner for support in some community infrastructure projects. And there would be improved, or could be improved, should be, on-island and off-island transportation facilities, and enhancements including bus routes, cycle paths, water taxi services, and so on. Increased capabilities of education and research using these lands. Indirect contribution to Bowen economy, spill-down effects of people coming here. Opportunity to acquire ecologically and recreationally significant land, private lands, such as CNIB, for example, and there are others we can think of. Opportunity to share funding for shared services, including fire protection, ambulance services, recycling, water, sewage, garbage. There would be protection of designated lands, for example, crown lands, and marine foreshores, including deep bay and watersheds, and that would be forever. Support for the majority of the goals of the Bowen Islands Official Community Plan and their implementation. Support for park-related enterprises, including water taxi, food services, commercial recreation and accommodation. Support for park-related volunteer and non-profit organizations. And finally, the upgrading of park and trail facilities to Park Canada's standards. And now we go to concerns.
So we put these concerns in alphabetical order just so we didn't have a fight about it. So bureaucracy was one of our concerns, and we heard it everywhere we went. Cumbersome bureaucracy, which is slow to respond. Camping concerns, these are concerns for Bowen Island. They were concerns for the other islanders, but it didn't seem to end up being a concern for them. Dog management, i.e. all national parks in Canada have an on-leash policy. Demand on our municipal resources and infrastructure, employment opportunities locally, will that happen and will that be a battle? Ferry overloads, i.e. numbers of people on our ferry and in our community. Features of park development, what and where will the park attractions be? Fees, park access fees, we're all concerned about that. Fire management, housing, will there be increased pressure on housing costs? Impact on private land. Some people might like the idea of national park beside their home, others not so. Lack of communication and cooperation is a concern. Loss of or restrictions of existing recreational uses. And then marine and foreshore use and regulation, i.e. our beaches, is one of our concerns around foreshore. Will they want part of our foreshore or not? How will they manage our marine areas?
And lastly, the summary and conclusion. I want to just point out that, as Colleen said in the very first part, we did go through all the issues we identified when we were sitting in Sturdy's Bay, and we felt we could solve, at least say, see a route to solve all the concerns. These aren't insoluble things. And we all agreed there were no showstoppers in terms of proceeding on the feasibility assessment process. So the summary, as we noted in the introduction, the National Park Committee of Council mandated the participants, that's us, to consider the pros and cons and possible opportunities that a national park could bring to Bowen Island. This report reflects the feelings of the public members of the group and is based on what we heard and saw during the two-day mission and our subsequent discussions. In addition, the public members have gone beyond the NPCC's mandate to participants and have suggested recommendations to the Parks Committee on what they feel needs to be done to ensure further community consultation so as many members of the Bowen Island community as possible can become informed on what will be a crucial future social and land use decision for the island. Our unanimous opinion was that the MPCC, the Parks Committee, and Bowen Islanders should proceed with caution and continue with the current feasibility assessment process. There is much to be discussed before the community will be in a position to take either a positive or negative position. The following reflects our wishes and a recommendation to the MPCC and Council. One, that the Council enters into a framework agreement with the province, Metro Vancouver and Parks Canada to explore further the creation of a national park on Bowen Island. That Council create a steering committee or task force to assist staff, the MPCC and Council in formulating the terms and conditions of a framework agreement for the creation of a national park. Three, that Council mandates the steering committee to consult with the Bowen community to address concerns and to explore opportunities presented by the creation of a national park on Bowen. And four, that Council ensures the committee is structured to represent all of the varied interests of Bowen Island. In conclusion, this is the end of our formal role as a group. We've done our thing, we now disband, if you will, and move forward into whatever process. And I'd just like to thank my colleagues, because it was a great trip. We learnt lots about each other. And believe me, travelling with a group of polar opposites in some cases, to arrive at any report with a consensus is an element of trust building and a very worthwhile process for us all. And I'd like to thank Parks Canada for hosting us on the tour and the accompaniment of our councillors, because it was a good trip. And I'm actually surprised Parks Canada got here today. You did check the gas in the tank this time before you left, didn't you? Because we got marooned. They ran out of gas in one of the boats. Anyway, thanks all. Thank you for coming, and we'll be open for questions here.
So let's move to some questions for these folks. I want to reiterate that I'm really impressed with just how this group came on board, got prepared in advance, participated in a very collegial, productive way, and then maybe surprising to everybody, sort of came quickly together at the end to sort of find sort of the where they agreed and where they didn't. So kudos to all of you for, I think, doing a really effective job in terms of pulling information together and now reporting back on it. So, so we have questions, and I'll just, if you want to direct it to an individual or to the group in general, we can, if you don't have a person in mind, then we can sort of direct the question.
I can direct the question. It's two parts. Both of them are to do with moving forward and should we end up in negotiations. So put that into the framework. I'll ask Colleen this question. I note that recommendation number four is for the establishment of a committee to proceed. It seems to me that we're now at a point where maybe the committee should, of course, represent the varied interests, but we are about to enter into some pretty serious discussions with a major player in our country, very respectable, but with huge amounts of talent and skill. It seems to me that our committee that we establish should probably have skills of legal experience in terms of negotiating with Parks Canada or at least with the federal government. Those sorts of skills are going to be incredibly important for us to make sure that we meet. Why didn't, or could I ask, would the committee be willing to put in a word or two to represent skills as well as interests?
When we met to put this document together, that was the last thing I asked to have in those recommendations. Funny, you should ask that. I wanted to put in a skills-based task force, I think. So now we're speaking as individuals here. I think that's critical. I'd hate to see it be a if we could have a skills-based group that was also representative of all of Bowen, that would be great. But I'd hate to see just a bunch of interested people who have strong opinions. I'd like to think if we're negotiating with somebody like the federal government who has a room full of lawyers, that we need to have skills-based people, some planners, some lawyers, some people that are good with contracts. I think that's critical for Bowen Island to make sure we find those people.
Okay, and thank you for answering that way. We did have this conversation before, but I actually raised the question. She said I was glad that I raised it. The second thing is just a comment, probably to you, Bob, or Maris, or Doug. It's in recommendation number one, it talks about meeting with the province and Metro Vancouver and Parks Canada. One of our biggest concerns that has come out over and over in relationship to this is transportation. I would like to see us move forward knowing that part of our discussion with the province must include the Ferry Corporation in the discussion and the planning right now, right from the get-go. So my recommendation to you is if you do proceed with recommendation number one, somehow that element is introduced.
Joyce, you're a tough act to follow. My question is fairly simple. You had mentioned in here under one of the most common issues that was experienced in other islands on the Gulf Islands National Park Reserve was the loss of a sense of community. And I was wondering if you can elaborate on that in terms of specific manifestations of that were expressed.
That's actually a concern that I also share here back on Bowen. In the Gulf Island National Park that we went to visit, a lot of the lands, private lands, that had historically had, even though they were private, like in a lot of situations, it's similar to on Bowen, where people are free to walk around and do what they want. And here on Bowen, we have an absentee landlord. A lot of our lands are owned by the province, and you're not here governing. And when you go from a situation where you can walk on lands and there's no one watching to there are people in uniform on those lands, something that you can and cannot do, it makes a little bit difference. It may not be the end of the world, but there is a change. Anyway, there's a change in your place and in the sense of place when you go from being able to walk around with nobody there and nobody telling you what you can and can't do to being on the top of Mount Gardner with your dog off a leash and having someone in uniform telling you that's wrong. And I think we all sense that possibility is here. And it was also something that they felt over there. It wasn't a showstopper. It wasn't something they can't live with, but it is a change. And there's a feeling, when you give over half of your land, as we would on Bowen Island, to somebody else, there's a sense of ownership, even though it's not ours right now. I feel when I walk around on Bowen Island that I own the land I walk around on. And when there's someone in uniform there, it feels a little different. And that's, I think, what they're trying to say.
Were there any other manifestation of that loss of a sense of community that were expressed by the respondents?
Just one more comment I'll make. Their situation was quite a bit different than ours. We have, the bulk of the lands we're in discussion on right now on Bowen Island are already public lands. They're provincial or they're municipal lands, so we're free to walk around on them. And our worry may not be as great as their worry was, because the bulk of the lands over there were private lands that were at threat for development or logging. So they jumped into this thing because they were worried about that. And they were very happy to have the Parks Canada come in and save them from that. There was a real sense of relief. And I think that sense of relief probably outweighed their concerns of the loss of ownership.
Thank you. I think there's a follow-up. Bruce, did you want to speak?
Yeah. I think this is a very important issue. We talk about Bowen Island, it has a certain style of life, a certain ethic, a certain way that we live. If we have a national park, we essentially change the governance of the island into two, the federal government and the municipal government. And so we will always have that, and it may impact the style of life that we like. So we have to recognize that that is an important aspect which we have to consider when we go forward with this, whether it's going to affect us, the municipality, and so forth. We will have no control over what the federal government does other than what we negotiate with them at the outset. Once we have the rules and the park is established, then we will operate under those rules. But our style of life might change because we will be restricted by about half the island under the federal government. So think about that and how we can maintain our way of life, because Bowen has a very distinct personality and the people in it enjoy that, and so it would be affected by a national park.
Could I just ask all the speakers to just introduce themselves for the people who don't know you?
My name is Ian Henley, and there's just a response to what Bruce said, and that has to do with accessibility to parklands. People here don't realize that there won't be a line around the park. The park will go to the foreshore, to the beaches, to any area which is crown land, and the foreshore is all crown land. There are many places that we now consider to be areas that we can use, and we won't be able to use them as we do now, or we may not be. But my reason why I'm up here now is I was shocked, quite seriously, by it being mentioned twice, the lack of transparency in dealing with Parks Canada. We were told that the people on the islands were not able to get copies of the agreement so they could review what their rights are and what their responsibilities are. Now, I would like to hear Parks Canada respond to that. I'm sure they will. They may have a very good answer, but at the moment, doesn't sound good to me.
Just as a comment, Ian, we immediately upon return from the trip, we wrote as a letter from council requesting release of that agreement from both the federal government, who's party to it, as well as the provincial government, who's party to it. So that has been sent to both ministers.
Yes, the agreement that was negotiated between the province and the federal government is a political agreement, so it's a political decision if it's going to be released or not. Since Bob has wrote his letter to our minister and to the provincial government, Islands Trust has actually done an access to information on the document. I know they passed a motion for that. So you're going to see some version of the document come out. It has nothing to do with the bureaucracy. It's not a bureaucratic decision. It's a political decision. It's a political agreement. The difference is it's signed by ministers of government, not by bureaucrats. So it's a partnership agreement. Both governments have to agree to release it. So now that the access to information has been made, the document will be released accordingly. So. Thank
you. You know, I recognize everyone's concerns about change. One thing I do think that we have a benefit from compared to the other islands is we have a municipality. We're actually better organized, better able to negotiate with Parks Canada because we have more structure here and more planning capability here. So, and to your point, Ian, the huge benefit of this trip was we learned from their experience of what to do, what to look out for. They didn't have that benefit when they went through the process. And they're learning, and a couple of them said to me, we wish we'd been able to do this, we just couldn't find any equivalents to go to. So as a community in the process, we have a huge benefit. of being the last one in, if you will, and knowing to ask about these types of issues. They just weren't aware of it, really, and they weren't structured because it's a bunch of different organizations working together, whereas we can focus through a municipality. So it's a benefit. But yeah, very much it's an issue that we felt we need to address and needs to be addressed up front.
My name's Will Husby. I've got a question for Parks Canada staff about the existing Gulf Islands National Parks Reserve. And it's about the whole idea of volunteer engagement. I know that Parks Canada has many parks in the system have a Friends of Society, and they do a whole bunch of things that assist the park. But they also have I've looked into what Parks Canada does, and you folks do things like have initiatives for community engagement, getting people involved in stewardship, not just walking around on the land, but people that have a passion for the land, there's opportunities for people to make meaningful, valuable contributions to that land. And I think I'd like to hear Parks Canada talk a little bit about that, because I'm hearing, you know, this fear from the community that, well, we can't go where we want to go and all that, but there's real benefits. I think you've probably encountered on the islands that you're already on that there's a lot of people that came there because they love that land. And I think that's a core of why a lot of us are on Bowen Island. And there's a lot of very knowledgeable and skilled people in these communities. And so I'm just wanting to hear what Parks Canada can do and is doing to engage people and give them a chance to do meaningful things in the lands that they love.
Probably give you a couple of good examples of what we've done with Gulf Islands. And every national park does have some sort of volunteer program or organized friends group. At Gulf Islands, in terms of working with the cultural interests on the islands, for example, in Pender Island, I think Pauline made reference to a small cottage tourist development. Well, it also housed one of the original homesteads on the island, and we work with the local historical society. They actually refurbished the building, and now they operate the community museum out of that house. So we worked out a license with them for them to do that. Right now we're working with the Conservancy on Main Island. We just started negotiations to look at, we're going to give them some operating space in the lightkeeper's house at Georgina Point, and in return they're going to do some of the invasive plant management on two of the properties on that island. We just did a shoreline cleanup program with the Oceans Discovery Center in Sydney, worked with us, other volunteer groups, the yachting clubs, host programs in the park in terms of educating people to the appropriate use of the park or things that they can see and do. We have a host program on Russell Island with the Hawaiian descendants of the Hawaiian settlers on Salt Spring, where they actually host a summer program and they tell about their heritage and their immigration to Canada, who they are now, where they've come from. So Rob has worked on a number of agreements with the local fire departments where we do some of the training or do some joint resourcing on projects like that. I think this year, haven't seen the stats for this year, but last year we had over 6,000 hours of volunteer time in the park. And we don't have a volunteer coordinator right now, so that's just individual staff working with individuals and community organizations. So it gives you a sense of the kind of programs we have.
So it's very clear that there's many mechanisms in the Parks Canada system for people that want to be involved in the maintaining the ecological integrity and the historic integrity of the land that they live on or live close to. There's many mechanisms there.
Well, again, that's another part of the Parks Canada mandate is to engage Canadians and communities, because we are the stewards of these places. These parks belong to you as Canadian citizens. They are your parks. So we're the stewards. The more we can engage people in, the more relevant they are, the more we're just our better chances of striving for that goal of ecological integrity or maintaining cultural resources. So, you know, we are a large organization as a federal agency, but we cannot do it all. We have to work with communities to help us meet those goals. So.
Okay, thanks. Hi, I'm Peter Arbuckle from Miller's Landing, and first of all, I'd like to thank the members of our community for your report. I, for one, have found that really helpful in helping me put things into perspective. I also want to thank the members of Parks Canada. You seem like really nice people, and frankly, I, for one, would like to get to know you more, because I think there's a great opportunity here. Your organization, however, scares the hell out of me. And I appreciate that you, as a steward of parks from coast to coast, have policies that need to be enforced on a national basis and a consistent basis from park to park. What worries me here on Bowen is, in particular, the amount of land we're talking about. And my comments, Your Worship, are perhaps to you and council and to the steering committee that you will set up. And I may regret this later, but I would be happy to let my name stand for that committee. Now, I'm sure I'll regret that later. But the point I'd like to make is it strikes me as I follow this process and at the earlier public meeting, and to sort of quote a paraphrase from John F. Kennedy, we seem to be taking an attitude on the island of seeing what we can do for Parks Canada. How much land can we give them? And especially when you start to throw in the issues of Crippen and the municipal beaches, as well as the 7 blocks of land, I think they were. And I frankly would be very cautious and make a recommendation that the first thing to negotiate would be the size of a park that meets Parks Canada terms for critical mass. And I appreciate you have a need for critical mass to justify the effort putting into creating a park. But I would rather see that we take a minimum amount of land and let them prove to us that their system can adapt what we need in our community. And then, frankly, if that works, have an option to add larger pieces of land to make that park bigger over time. In particular, I look at our beaches and I look at Crippen. And I think over time, the management of those areas, we found an equilibrium between the population of Bowen and the management of those public areas. And I use as a case in point the walking of dogs off leash in Crippen. Because if I'm not mistaken, it is a similar policy within Metro Vancouver Regional Parks that it is an on-leash policy. But it seems to have been relaxed here on Bowen because that was the request or the necessity from the citizenry, and it's found that equilibrium. I know some people are not in favor of off-leash facilities in Crippen, but it strikes me as I walk through Crippen a lot with and without dogs that we've found that equilibrium. So I think that we should be comfortable in a position of strength here. We have these places now. They're ours, and they belong to the community. I'm delighted that we should be working with Parks Canada, but as my Gaelic ancestors would say, I think we should go canny and be careful and really view this from a position of strength. Because what I hear from your committee's report is there are some great benefits, but there's a huge bureaucracy that goes with it. And that bureaucracy is going to have a lot of difficulty adapting to the particular needs of our community. Thanks.
Thank you, Peter.
Hi, I'm Kat Hedak. My question is, a lot of the issues have to do with the potential traffic coming from Vancouver. Is there a budget or a plan set aside to gather some statistics from the public in Vancouver as to whether adding this park will increase tourism to Bowen significantly and how significantly?
We have begun the process of collecting statistics from BC Ferries, for example, to see what the traffic, the ridership is at the current point in time. I think you're referring to, are we going to poll the city of Vancouver to see whether who would like to come to Bowen Island? I'm being a little facetious there, but we will be holding, and we can hold meetings with Vancouver audiences, as we have already in West and North Van, to get a sense of
of whether they would come to Bowen. If they did, what would they like to do when they got here? We can certainly do that. To what extent we will do that throughout Vancouver remains uncertain. We haven't figured that out yet. That's a good point.
Can I just add to that? I did ask West Vancouver if they had any stats on White Cliff Park and Lighthouse Park in terms of visitation, and they don't.
We're also doing a cost-benefit analysis. I'll just add to that, to my response, is that we are looking at trying to determine how much, to what degree a new visitation would come to a national park, to a national park on Bowen Island. So it's a bit of a guessing game at the best of times, but we are trying to determine what realistic visitation levels we can expect. And we'll get back to you on that probably by December or January.
Hi, I'm Dan Cowan, and a little bit here. I sent an email to Bob, and I've talked to Bill, and I'm representing basically a lot of people who are not here today, and that's because they're out there enjoying Crown Lands. And I'd like to also point out that, you know, I am the youngest person probably in this room here. No offense or anything, but it's just, my question is, you know, well, I've read through this thing. There's a lot of things. This one kind of got to me the most. Loss of sense of freedom and ownership of what was historically thought as theirs. So I'm a mountain biker, and I don't know how many people know me or heard of me, but I'm the mountain bike guy on the island, and I've literally spent 5,000 hours up there on the mountain with my bike riding in the woods. And I know that federal parks have policies and all this stuff, and I got a good letter back from Bill, and I'm not against federal parks by any means, but obviously I've said to Bob, it's actually, you know, makes me physically ill to think that all that passionate time I've spent up in the woods is now, you know, in jeopardy, and it's not going to be allowed. And it's not because you don't like mountain biking, or you don't like mountain biking, or you guys don't like mountain biking, but it's just, that's, you know, there's all sorts of issues, and I've dealt with it before on the North Shore of Vancouver. I moved here 10 years ago, and when I started on these Crown Lands, it's, you know, I know it's Crown Lands, but I think I have a right to be able to ride my bike in the Crown Lands, and it just so happens in order to ride a bike in Crown Lands, you need to make a trail. And, you know, I have lots of trails up there, and if anybody's ever interested, I'd be more than happy to show them to you. And I know for sure that pretty much, maybe there's one person over there, and Bob's seen a few of them, and maybe, I don't know, have you maybe seen a few of them, and... You've seen a few of them, yeah. So, you know, not many people have seen them, and I wanted to keep it that way, but I felt that I needed to come up and say something here. And as I said, I am by myself pretty much today. I know Kim rides a bike over there, but there are mountain bikers who just happen to be out mountain biking or, you know, doing something outside today. And I, because I'm the builder of all these trails, I feel I need to say something, ask something. What are, you know, is it? Because the bottom line for me is I'm scared of even if I didn't ride a bike, the fact is I like to go hiking wherever I want to go, whenever, you know, like I hike up the mountain all the time. I'm up there 4 or 5 days a week, and the thought of having a park is, I gotta admit, it's like, ooh, scary. It's very scary, because, you know, having a ranger telling me or where I can go and when I can't go and all these things. So what was my question? I know mountain biking is a very specific use, but then what other uses are there in national park? There's horseback riding. And also, I mean, you know, like, this island needs activities for young people to do. And really, like, yeah. You know, there's soccer, and soccer's a great sport. My wife's from Argentina, and, you know, we're into soccer, but I personally don't play soccer, and I like to play tennis.
Yeah, could I pose a question for you?
Sorry, you pose a question, yeah.
Yeah, how do national parks accommodate mountain biking? Or how could this national park accommodate mountain biking, a national park on Bowen Island?
Yeah, excuse me. So I wrote a letter to Dan about this, and so he knows what the answer is. But mountain biking is an activity that's enjoyed in many national parks across Canada.
the accepted form of mountain biking is cross country, and as I said in my letter, so there are most zones in national parks that are the wilder, the more remote, can accommodate on a park by park basis. This can vary from park to park. Can accommodate mountain biking on a cross country basis.
Yeah.
The wilder zones of a national park do not generally provide for engineered structures. That is the distinction. So,
yeah.
the distinction is cross country versus downhill.
Yeah.
And downhill comes with a number of structures.
Well,
and
I don't need to tell you that. Well, no,
but
actually it doesn't. I'm an expert, obviously, in mountain biking. I'm know all the different forms of mountain biking. I've been doing it for 20 years, and I'm one of the pioneers of Canadian cultural mountain biking. That's actually what I said in my letter. As I said, this is a cultural thing here, and it just so happened, you know, I happen to be part of that culture, and I moved to Bowen and spread my culture up there on the mountain. But as far as structures go, there's really, most of my trails there do not have structures. They're just down the terrain, and the terrain just so happens to be.
So could I again just focus that question? There are, you're answering, I understand, there are trails, and then there are trails with structures, and those are treated as two different types of things.
Generally speaking,
and
yes.
And then you built trails.
Yeah.
You built trails with structures.
Yeah, but now, generally speaking, all mountain biking, North American wide, worldwide, it's generally accepted. You can go to any community, any town in BC, and mountain biking trails have structures. Like, period.
Dan, I'd like to move on. We've got other people.
Yeah, I know.
Now.
Sorry.
So,
anyways,
no,
thank
you
very
made
much.
Your point, but I just wanted to make sure we'd heard the answer to the question. So, was there more?
Well, just one other piece. It is possible within the higher development zones of national parks to have bike parks, as I mentioned in your letter.
Yeah.
So it is possible, but not generally speaking. And I see Rob wants to jump in here.
Yeah.
Not generally speaking in the wilder zones, but did you want to?
Can I just point out too, because a lot of people here aren't from bike parks. When you're talking about bike parks, you're talking something similar to what we have already over there.
Yes.
Maybe slightly bigger, but that's great and it's nice and everything, but it's for real mountain biking. It's not, you know.
No, I understand that for sure. So we can discuss this.
Sure, yeah. Anyways, thanks for the time. Thanks for listening. And
thanks, Dan. Comment from John?
Hello.
Yeah, I'd just like to add one point. A couple speakers previous to Dan, as well as Dan and myself, share a kind of common concern, and that is the all-or-nothing approach of a national park on Bowen. If we have to feel the pain of sudden change on all of the land, it's going to be pretty tough on people like Dan and what he's doing. It's going to be tough on me and what I do. And this is why I think we should be looking at phasing in this national park. And one of the previous speakers spoke about, you know, we enter into it, maybe a smaller step. If it works out well, we continue. Or we have a plan for it all to be national park, but over time. I, as somebody who walk on Mount Garner several times a week with my dogs, I'd be much more comfortable with the national park of Mount Garner existing 10 years from today than I would tomorrow, because by that time my dogs are dead and I'm not walking. And Dan's structures might have collapsed by then. And when you push things off in time a little bit, it gets a lot easier to say yes. And so I'm just sort of re-emphasizing that point that there is the possibility to phase this thing in.
Can I just add one? And I just also want to add, and this is also along the theme of what will be the uses and what will not be allowed in the parks. I did actually ask a question, Dan, specifically about the trails on the Crown Land, because I have seen them, and you guys are really crazy. Those things are really scary, some of them. But regardless, that's one of my questions. What if, you know, this is a use that we've enjoyed on the Crown Lands? What will happen? So what we heard back, and I heard this both from Parks Canada personnel and from the Islanders in terms of recommendations, and also from Mel Turner, who is the consultant, the Parks consultant, is we have to be really clear. Well, first of all, there will be in the management plan some room for negotiations of those uses that are currently that we use in terms of how we use the park now. So if there's a tradition or an accepted use now, we can negotiate and talk about those uses and ensure that they continue if we want them. So we have to be really clear what we want, we have to be very specific, and we have to negotiate very hard for those things. That's what we're hearing. So whether it's walking dogs off leash, whether it's bikes in Crown Lands, whatever it is, we need to bring those things to the table. And that's where we have to be really clear as a community, and as I said, preferably with a unified voice, is to come to Parks Canada and say, these are non-negotiable, and this is what we want to talk about.
So I'm going to take two more questions, and then I think we're going to move into a break. And beyond that, we have the breakout sessions for those people who want to stay and sort of directly discuss. So I see you walking up, Fitch. Are you the third? A short question? To the point. Okay, great.
My name is Shannon Bentley, and thank you for the opportunity to ask a question. I've been listening, and it sounds as though the public consultation process is going along well. My question is to Parks Canada, and I'd like to zoom out a little bit from this public consultation discussion to another consultation process that the federal government is under a legal duty and obligation to conduct with First Nations, and not only to consult but also to accommodate Aboriginal rights and title. And I think it would be very helpful for everyone here to be able to put our public consultation discussion into the context of what your legal duty is and how that will impinge on this process. Thank you.
Yeah. So when it comes to Aboriginal rights, as I said before, they already apply to Crown Lands here. The question is whether creating a national park will have any infringement on those rights. And if the First Nations were to think that somehow a national park would, then that's where we have a duty to try to accommodate. That doesn't mean we will, because there are some principles here, public safety, conservation, those kinds of things override those rights in certain circumstances. But the question is whether a national park is going to infringe on the current rights that apply. And that's the discussion that we have with First Nations. So it's a matter of their asserted rights as opposed to how it may affect the operation or management of the national park. And to date in the Gulf Islands, and again, we're working with 17 First Nations. I don't think we've seen a real conflict. There's been some need to gain greater public awareness of some of the archaeological sites or the cultural resources and the need to protect those and respect those. But I would think that we're achieving that and we're gaining that common understanding. I don't really see direct conflict in any way. So.
I'd like to make a bit of a comment on that. We as a local government don't have any sort of direct negotiation with the First Nations, but in an effort to be a good neighbor, and on the advice of our MLA Joan McIntyre, when the Parks Committee met with Joan earlier in January, she suggested that as a good neighbor, go and have a chat with Squamish Nation, who do assert interest. This is their traditional territory. So I met with Chief Gibby Jacob in January and just said as much as that we were pursuing this with Parks Canada. We didn't know where it was going, but we just wanted to give them a heads up that this may, in fact, come to pass. And about 2 weeks ago, I then, as an introductory meeting with Steve Langdon, who is sort of field unit area manager for Parks Canada, we met with Squamish Nation chiefs, again, as an introductory meeting. I'm not involved in the process, but the purpose was really, as a good neighbor, just to say we are engaging Bowen Island in this consultation. I know you'll be doing your own consultation, and we're all interested in sort of working together wherever it's appropriate to work together.
Hi, I'm Teresa Plowright, and want to thank everybody for doing such a great job on that trip, and for Parks Canada for supporting that trip, and I thought the report was really excellent. So I want to agree with a couple of comments about the scope of the park. That's kind of always been my concern. I hear us asking Parks Canada whether we'll be able to do certain activities which we have all enjoyed for many years. And I'm a little distressed that that's our situation here. Are we going to be able to mountain bike? Are we going to be able to walk our dogs? I totally agree with what John's remarks about how we have a sense of ownership when we take our pets or walk with our friends in a sense of privacy. You don't have the same sense and appreciation of nature when you're sharing it with a lot of people. That's just the case. And parks are wonderful. National parks are great, but they are meant to serve a lot of people, and that's their mandate, and that's what they should do. So for me, it comes down to the size and the footprint of the park. Because something like Dogs Off Leash, we're not going to come to a compromise on it. National Parks has an issue, has a stance on that. So I, from the very beginning, wondered why we have to have such a big footprint. And that, I think, is something that looks very good from Parks Canada point of view. From our point of view, a lot of this land is protected already, so we're not gaining that benefit of protected land, which some of the other Gulf Islands do. So I just think, why do we have to have that size? And especially if we're looking at more land from the surplus parks, this is an issue that was new to me. I would like there to be still locals kind of Bowen, a place that we can go to where we know we can do the things we've done for like my 20 years and probably a lot more. And I guess if I have a question about all this, it's are there ways to consider smaller footprints? Is somebody going to be addressing that? And the bigger question for me is, do we ever get to say no here? Because as far as I can understand it, Bowen Island isn't a decision maker. Parks Canada is the decision maker. They're undertaking a feasibility study, and we're giving views and feedback. And I don't even know if that's 100% right, but that's sort of what I've been able to glean about the project, the process of it, and perhaps that's wrong.
Well, you posed a question about a smaller footprint, and I'll leave that to Parks Canada to answer. But with regard to Bowen Island's role in this, Parks Canada's made it very clear to us. Our MLA has made it very clear to us. That if Bowen Island doesn't want this park, our MLA is not going to support it. These are provincial lands. They have to be transferred by the province to any national park. And she wouldn't be supporting a transfer if it is not strongly supported on Bowen Island. Likewise, Bowen Island Council will be doing this exactly the same thing. We won't be supporting it. And Parks Canada has made it very clear to us that our collective community support for this is essential in their recommending going forward on a feasibility study, or basically a yes on a feasibility study.
Okay, thanks, Bob. I really appreciate hearing that.
But I'll turn it then to Parks Canada.
And I love parks.
Thank you. And I'll just reinforce what Bob said. I mean, it's absolutely true. That's we're in a collaborative process here, and that's the way it's going to work. To get back to your earlier question about the size of the park, the footprint, what we're doing right now is looking at all of the public lands on Bowen Island. That doesn't mean that a national park has to encompass all of the public lands on Bowen Island. We're hearing loud and clear that perhaps we need to consider not, I mean, some lands, yes, some lands, perhaps not. Perhaps they're better left in another management category. And we're looking at all of that. Having said that, Parks Canada will likely have some kind of a bottom line, some kind of a minimum that makes having a national park here worth the investment and that we would inevitably put into a national park. So we have to decide what our minimums are, both from a representation point of view, from a visitor experience point of view, and we will be undertaking that work over the course of the next few months. And with that knowledge in hand, we'll certainly be able to discuss further with you when we develop a park concept, what's in, what's out, just how big should this national park be, or could it be, and what lands should be in, what lands should be out. I think that's a very valid question. It's a very valid piece of work that we need to do.
Thanks. I also wondered if there's like management strategies too, where people tend to go to certain parts of the park and others are designated less accessible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, those, as we mentioned before, there are various zones within a national park, and the level of protection and use varies with those zones.
Okay, thanks very much.
Okay, last question to you, Finch.
Comment? There's a statement made by the last speaker about this land is protected, this Crown land is protected. Well, it isn't. Crown land belongs to the Crown, and the Crown can use it as it sees fit. It can log it, it can mine it, it can also sell it for development. We've just spent 5 years negotiating with the Crown to get a nature reserve, which is called Fairy Fen, and it's a lot of stuff in the undercurrent last week about it. It took us 5 years, and the Crown valued that land on the basis of commercial property. And that is the way the Crown regards land, that it has the right to sell land for commercial development. So to have this blithe assumption that what we're enjoying at the moment on Crown land is always there and is our right to have, is actually simply isn't valid. The federal park, if it happens, does give it protection.
Sorry, I just want to clarify, I'm aware of that with the Crown lands, but we're talking about Crippen Park as well.
Different.
Which is, I don't know what percentage it is of the proposed footprint, but it's a big piece.
Yeah,
as well.
Crippen is protected, you're quite right.
I'm Fitch Kay. I've been here 5 short years. I wasn't here when the island became a municipality. But I think going forward, this is certainly as large an issue as that. My concern is about the governance of the village going into this, and if it comes to be passed, governance going forward in relationship to the yin and yang of having such a large portion of the island nationalized by the federal government, which it seems to be in a hurry to get here, but by what's been discussed about responses on the islands and the Gulf Islands, slow to respond afterwards. My concern at the front of this is that there be a referendum on this. I think this is way too big an issue for council. I think as part of the agreement, there should be a binding referendum that goes up to a yes or no vote for the citizens and the villagers involved to vote on it. And I want to vote on it, not representation vote on it. I want to come into this gymnasium and vote. Thank you.
Just as a comment, yeah, I see that. Where are we going from here? Just to clarify, I mean, there will be the report get brought forward by the Citizens Committee is going to be rolled into a report from the Council Committee, and that will be brought forward to Council, I think, on the October 18th Council meeting with recommendations on sort of the process going forward. And so one of the question you're asking is one of those questions, it's an option for how do we get to the question, or how do we answer the question, does Bowen support this? And I hear your comment.
Yeah, Bob, I just wanted to add, you know, we're getting towards the point where how do we get to yes on a park? And I think it's one thing that we haven't talked much about today. Most of the discussion today has been about the park and its impacts on us and how can we live with that and what. And what's been left out was one of the bigger takeaways for me when I went to the Gulf Island Reserve was when I heard that the federal government had spent $30 million acquiring private land. They then spent $16 million over 5 years making capital improvements, and they now have a $3 million annual operating budget. So that's $46 million that they spent to make it work over there. And I see on Bowen Island, we have a segment of our community that would give their right arm to have a park and ask for nothing in return. But there's also a segment in our community that is not so sure about that. And those are the ones we have to work with if we're going to get to yes. And when I see numbers like $46 million, and I think of the needs on this island that can be achieved through park development rather than guys like me who put up houses, that's an opportunity. And that's why I think we really need a steering committee, which is, if anything, weighted a little away from the people that would give their right arm, and get those people to negotiate hard, because there's a lot of resources here to solve a lot of problems on Bowen Island, and we need the right people there bargaining for us. Thanks.
Thanks, John. And where are we going from here? We're going to a break. And after the break, which will be about 10 minutes, we'll keep it short because we would encourage people to hang around and sit at a table. There will be tables, and if you look on the flip charts over on that end and along the wall, it's identified with different issues. And if you're able to stay and participate, then please do. Thank you.